share our good ideas and myself and the local teacher. I believe we reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. And if you have time to ask yourself what's in the direction of me. Before we begin, as always, I would like to thank you and please take over the house and pass. I'm quite happy for many those who might from the Dana Alio for signing the committee tonight. Today, we are returning to Executive Order 121, the application of the Department of Health and Social Services. It is our intent today to hear public testimony, have a chance to ask any questions, final questions of the department in which we have legal, and finally, wrap up discussion on the executive order. We will get to the rule of the committee and I have special comments on Resolution 2 on whether to disagree with the executive order. Later in the meeting, we will come to explain the governor's appointees to the state medical board, David Wilson and Matt Lenora. Later this afternoon. Alright. On January 17th, the governor transmitted Executive Order 121 to the House, where it was introduced on January 18th. At previous Executive Order 119, he proposes to reorganize the Department of Health and Social Services into the Department of Health and the Department of Social and Community Services. For Article 3, Section 23 of the Alaska Constitution, the legislature has 60 days to conduct due diligence and consider whether to take no action accepting the governor's proposal or be disappointed or reject the order. Further, the federal rule 4984 to disapprove an executive order requires a special concurrent resolution to be considered by a standing committee of each house and may be adopted by a majority vote of 4% of the legislature in joint session. Today, we are returning to consideration of HSCR 2. Which quite simply is a disapproval of the enactment of Executive Order 121. I'd like to acknowledge that available for questions and discussion are Adam Crane, Commissioner of the Department of Health and Social Services, Sylvia Moore, Assistant Commissioner of the Department of Health and Social Services, Stacey Craley, Director of the Civil Division of Law, and Andrew Dunbar, from the Legislative Council. We are back on the record, and we will begin with public testimony on Executive Order 121 and HSCR 2 at this time. Is there anyone in the room who wishes to testify? Right, seeing none, we will turn to those who have called in to testify. First on the line, we have Marianne Mills. Marianne, if you can begin by putting your name and information on the record and begin with your testimony. Thank you.
my name is Julie Smith. I am calling on behalf of myself. I am calling today to ask you to support the resolution and stop the executive order. I am a person who uses the services by the NHSS. I have not been contacted to ask if any changes made will impact my life. And I talked to my case manager that they deal with any possible changes, and they will not feel either. So until we are able to understand more and have more communication with the people who this will impact and the families that this will impact, and we are able to give answers to people such as myself, I would like the process to be stopped because we need more information. Thank you very much. My name is Dr. McLeod. My group today is my own. I'm not affiliated with my employer. I hope the language is realized on the HHS program and services. It's the story that we saw of you today. And this teacher provided me to vote yes on this resolution. But this is for the resolution page, executive order, because it doesn't pass muster. It was upending people's lives at a time when they're doing this narrative and upending legislative authority and powers. I've talked to many committee meetings where DHSS leadership made their presentations and found it so real that every director stated that it would solve their biggest problems. Getting the community attention. First time I heard it, I found it bizarre. But when those directors, one after the other, badges are sprayed on their PowerPoint to show the benefits of collaborations with each other and how leadership will then support the models forward. First of all, why aren't they already collaborating with each other to take advantage of those economies of scale, but this is to all supply costs? My first job with the state was with fish and game supply and chewing supply with pounds. We get it all the time. Secondly, you have to ask yourself, why is it that these directors have to clamor for the attention of their commissioner? As commissioners through the years have, I've known a couple of them, they may be having problems getting attention by focusing on their debts and demands. We need to create a whole brand new department out of home talk so that directors can collaborate better and the HSS leadership will pay better attention. Thirdly, while powerful stakeholders and staff have had a chance to provide input, there are hundreds of families in Alaska who rely on government services who are not given that chance. In fact, in response to a question about if a city has something important about this step, the leader commented that it wasn't required. Well, that speaks volumes. Do you really trust leadership to interplay the split of the department and implement it without having told hundreds of thousands of stakeholders? If same leadership would totally mess up the low-cost rollout of the Alaska Psychiatric Institute, I saw firsthand how perilous that rollout was. How about Medicaid adult dental preventive program that they missed out, and deceptively kept vital information from Medicaid recipients to loans. But the governance of the Alaska program was not legal, and the program was still active. Do you really trust them to undertake such a big task in this reorganization? Lastly, what about your own business? Will you come down on the sides of Alaskans in big government? Or will you cede your legislative authority and power, set precedent, and enable this governor and DHSS leadership to wreak havoc on your safety net while it grows the budget by millions and expands the bureaucracy at Alaskans' expense? Just because the executive branch has the right to grow reorganized, it doesn't have the right to cause chaos, confusion, and consternation to hundreds of thousands of our most vulnerable Alaskans who experience hardships in their daily lives and rely on DHSS's programs and services to get by in some sort of normal fashion. Thank you.
Next, we have Robbie O'Donoghue. If you could begin by introducing yourself and putting your affiliation on record and begin your testimony.
Thank you. Good afternoon. I'm Mark Meyer with the Social Services Committee. My name is Robbie O'Donoghue. I'm calling and representing the Alaska Public Interest Research Group, AFCA, to support House Concurrent Resolution 2 and the Executive Order of West 21. Our organization has been closely following the process of Executive Order of West 21. Listening to each of the hearings on the first slide and doing our own research in order to actually participate in the process, and by asking the Alaska Institute sessions created for Sentence of 11 to 13 United Cups money, which to us indicates the need for more preparation for undertaking such an important site. We believe that many of the issues for our first staff have been important results in this, so the best could refer to be addressed entirely in the process today. We would ask that you'd like to bring to your attention is the precedent to our only sessions 129 to manage our site for the site. I've been anxious to call in the end of the executive branch, taking my own research and our state agency and fulfilling the mandate of the legislative index. This is the greatest part of the level of the state of the legislative legal department, which cut out all these flaws and contradictions in the executive order, as well as clear executive overreach. As a political branch of government, it is our sole decision to address the HRPRQ to allow for an uptick in government and properly investigate this proposal. Thank you for your time and your service to the people of Boston.
Thank you for your testimony. Thank you.
Baselines that exist, and what are the smart models that we can see that remove from those benchmarks that are intrusive to those that are effective in helping Alaskans. So I'm not opposed to a bifurcation of this. I do want to see things that we can see movement in an interaction and not something that is single district in a longitudinal 10-year study or see an effectiveness of this next year. And I think that with that is in the power of coming out of a bill this year. And yes, my presentation, but this year I have to go with the bifurcation to clean up the language of three and move in the direction to help the management of three Alaskans. Thank you.
Stakeholder engagement process and this effort has been lacking. I think that there were, certainly more stakeholder engagement this year, and that was people see there was clarity that it felt like there was one way stakeholder engagement. But I've heard from stakeholders who had consulted about the executive order, and they were essentially informed about the executive order and how it's going to make things better, but they wasn't considered in terms of how to make the reward better, how to use it as an opportunity to prepare content. The issue now before us is that we have kind of an incomplete package. We have a package that's been submitted to the legislature that has the executive order, and it doesn't have to be planning legislation that's absolutely necessary to make sure that it works. It's essentially what the administration has said, and we know that this is an imperfect process. We know that it needs to be fixed. Not that we fix it, but that we the legislature allows the executive order to go forward, and then we'll come back next year and fix it. And the rationale for coming back next year was that there was concern that a companion bill to fix the errors in the executive order and or the results of the policy goals that had been given in the executive order would be Christmas tree. It's my position that if really good stakeholder engagement had been done, there would be a lot of alignment consensus, and there would probably have people in this building advocating for the executive order and for the accompanying component legislation. Because they would have been involved in the process, they would have been a part of creating any solutions. Instead, what we're hearing from largely are folks that are employees of the administration advocating for their reward and members of the public who make it their business to keep an eye on these things, it's not that because they're afraid of being penalized or that they're never being candidate in their position or have expressed concern here today on the record. I believe that for a lot of folks who are concerned with their relationship with the administration would be jeopardized and their ability to deliver on their mission would be jeopardized if they were to be candidate at their testimony about this. And this is really important because as this committee knows very well, most of the services they're delivered by the Department of Health and Social Services are actually delivered by, low-income organizations and nonprofit organizations throughout the state of Alaska. And they can't do the work and not hold the reason they can't do this work if they don't have a good relationship with the department. So we're sort of in a situation where we've been given something that is half-baked, and the administration said, we're not going to propose to get all the way and put the frosting on the cake and deliver it, in full with chemicals on it. Instead, the legislature could see grants, you could maybe fix it and then that could be your problem, or maybe we could extend out the stress of the transition legislation. That really concerns me because trying to have a really big bill. There's nothing more stressful than trying to version and there may be unnecessary or difficult by a poor stakeholder engagement and poor rulemaking process. If everybody knows where they're going to get to on the other side, what they're going to get is like a deal, sometimes you better not look through it. You know, when you go on a hike and you really get like, but you know you're going to this amazing first up the top and all worth it, and then on the way back, you know you're going to have a better deal and it's all worth it. But I think we can use our bonds with a little bit of a slump, and right now I think that we've been preventing the whole thing that is just slowed with no clear vista at the end and no wonderful dinner at the end either. And so it's not really clear what we're getting out of it. It's just sort of things are going to be better on the other side. I don't know whether that's going to prove it. I looked at dinner for us today. So rather than advancing the executive order, I support, you know, passing this resolution and a slower, methodical approach to this that involves really deep rich stakeholder engagement. And this committee, policy committee, as part of the House Finance Subcommittee, approved $500,000 to do more robust stakeholder engagement over the next year. And I think that was really thoughtful, and I appreciate the Coach Smaller for advancing that budget amendment, because I think like that would, if we already go through that process, then we begin to come back with a more aligned community around this, and we can have a more smoother process, a better product, and less stress for everybody, and for all of which means we'll be serving the right culture. Thank you.
Thank you, Co-Chair. So, I am opposed to this resolution. This is just a judgment call. The problems with the services provided by both the family side of it and the outside of it have been known for so long, and you have to just make a decision and move on. And I guess the amount of work and effort and detail that has been put into this process by the administration is much more robust than what I have seen in organizations in another community. The size, I suppose, but I think there's been quite a bit of discussion. There's been plenty of thought into it. The ideas, from what I've heard, come from long time employees within the organization, and I think that they have done about as good as we can expect to prepare for it, and therefore we just need to there's not a lot of downside risk, but there's plenty of upside risk, so I think it's worth getting in that race. Thank you.
So I'm a little confused. Are we just making closing comments, or are we also asking questions?
I do support moving forward, so we can have an opinion here, but I won't say that I'm going to move on it. I'm wondering if there's much more there, so I'm looking for questions.
Indeed, yes.
Okay, so Mr. Dunmeyer, that's your chair. I was reading through your legal memo. I was going through it, and it seems like, let me back up. So I was reviewing the memo. Article 3, Section 23. It's very clear to me that the governor does have the authority to reorganize departments. And if I'm ready for the second half, it says, when these changes require the force of law, they shall be set forth in executive orders. And executive orders. The legislature shall have such a duty to bring a section for a full session. people for consideration and disapprove of using executive orders. So it would seem to me that it would be impossible to have an executive order that merged the departments or supposed departments to find the actual health change statute. That traditional remedy for allowing somebody who is an emergency hospital event in the day, and I'm always concerned about maintaining separation of powers. And so, lawmaking power being reserved to legislatures is a big concern of mine. Whether that attack comes from the executive branch or the courts, sometimes can happen. So, I am worried about that, but it seems to me that there's a process in the Constitution here to make it very clear, because literally it's impossible to dismount this without making statutory changes. So the question I would have is, I guess going further down the line, it would seem that because the departments are massive, that in order to split it, you actually have to make policy calls about what goes where in terms of which commissioners is on which board that kind of thing. So I guess the first question I have for Mr. Gilmore is, do you see it as being possible to split a department at this scale without making policy calls in the process with an executive order?
The role of the chair to represent Congress is not at a very conventional level. I don't think it would be possible to split a large principal department by executive order without in some way or another making policy calls through the process.
Okay, anyway. The second question is, so going through your memo, some of the concerns you raised seem more or less just, I don't know, not significant, but it's an issue of inclusion. The administration had to make a call on it, but some of the other concerns that go to the government, and I guess, can you point out in your memo the sections of the executive order that maybe make an unnecessary policy bill where the administration could have gone down the line of not making a policy bill and decided to split certain items, but didn't have to make substantial policy changes right or make substantial policy changes? If that makes sense. And I think one of the things I looked at here on page 4 here, under the memo, sections 27, I guess it's section 27 of the executive order, you cite grants 44.25260. Well, I guess if you could just speak to section 27 some more. I'm specific a lot, but the 2-0 statutes are referenced there, the 3 versus 4. And sections like that, where it does make a substantial policy change of law, it's not just the commissioner or the department, but the split executive has to make a call, but they make a call if necessary. I guess my question is, how
do you use the kind of thing? Thank you. commissioner of the Department of Health and Social Services is available to the board of the Mental Health Trust Authority. In this executive order, the department has come to the table so that when the commissioner over the two of the departments will sit on the board rather than two commissioners. In this case, they would like the commissioner of health. The department got a memo that results in the commissioner who receives CPI.
Thank you, Chair. So that's Amy. And thank you to everyone who has been here from today for coming this morning. Thank you to everyone from the department who's on the line and we can feel free to know what I can say about all the news leading up to this. And I do have a few closing comments that I think could also just quickly respond to Commissioner Kirk's favorite inquiries. And we did start to go down that little bit of a rabbit hole in some previous hearings, and I think these are good questions. I think we heard from the Department of Law, we heard some Judge Regal about the increase in EO reorganization of the department is really permissible, and the assignment of functions within the departments are legally permissible. There starts to become some gray areas and questions and cause for concern when we see expansion or shrinking of authority. And it really does seem to me to set maybe a couple areas, some questions related by Mr. Dunn there that might be cause for concern, but also that they could possibly be connected with a piece of companion legislation. One of them had to do with renaming one of the duties associated with the department. The original statute is to not call for them. You know, it's called welfare and delinquency, and it would technically be thought of as that's an expansion, and what does that actually mean, and what are the implications? There was some, and most likely I would say that there was some problematic wording with respect to one of the new departments and the loose language. You could take a liberal reading of that and create it to be that you had authority over non health related departments, and you want to clean that up in legislation so that happens. And then to your last thing, which has been talked about, board membership, it does concentrate board membership heavily, if not entirely, in Department of Health. And I think that's something as a legislature we need to think about whether or not that's a good thing, if that makes sense. And at the end of the day, legal concerns aside, it's ultimately the legislatures that are important now to decide whether or not the EO. In this case, the ratification is something that we want to go forward, and it doesn't have to be on these legal grounds of expansion or contraction before it can be for whatever reason that we're hearing from stakeholders or that we find out during our due diligence. So just kind of pointing that. With respect to the few comments that I want to take a moment, I think this has to be with the one of the committee. So I did want to say that what do I hope I made myself clear here in my conversations with department leadership that I strongly support efforts to improve the functionality and efficacy and the oversight of the department. And I hope that that commitment can be seen just in this recent session and my own involvement with House Bill 172 and House Bill 292 and House Bill 168. I really enjoyed my opportunities to work with the department and improve the function and services. And I'm grateful for the hard work and dedication of DHS leadership, particularly over the last 2 years. All that said, because it is our duty to do due diligence and closely review the EO, there are several concerns in my mind that remain with respect to moving this forward. I don't have additional questions because the questions still remain for me. I'm not, there doesn't seem to be answers, and the lack of answers there is not the cause of concern for me. So, through, and we're all intimately familiar with the persistent challenges that we're seeing in the different divisions and programs. And I guess that shouldn't be a surprise. We have increasing vacancy rates. We don't have the people and the resources that we need on the front line, and I guess we shouldn't be terribly surprised that we're seeing some of these challenges. We've heard over and over again that due to the increasing budget, in some cases, the volatility in the budget, we're seeing workforce burnout, we're seeing issues recruitment and retention, and we're seeing aging technological infrastructure. So to represent a practice point, I think we do know what some of the problems are. We probably don't get to study those aspects of the problem. But in my mind, I don't see how 13 new positions at $2 million annually is the solution to those particular problems. They won't cover the frontline workers that we need, and they won't cover the technological improvements that we need. And it does give me pause, particularly as I'm talking to individuals who work in DPA or individuals who are on the wait list for base care and the list can maybe wander out in terms of people who are directly impacted. And I guess the other thing that my colleague, made a point, and I think Representative Puerta is also a family is on your mind, just thinking about the president. At this view, would say, well, you know, the biggest thing, the size of it in and of itself is not a legal issue, but it's one that I think the legislature would be wise to at least consider, are we comfortable setting this precedent? And ultimately, we may decide as a body that we are comfortable, but I think it's something that we should look at eyes wide open and make a decision on. And I think you're right about that. I think we're doing it in good shape here in the House Committee, and I think it's getting good federal reviews in some subsequent committees, and keep looking at this. So we've talked about that. I guess the last thing I want to say is I'm glad that we're able to move this resolution because it allows us to keep the process going. It allows us to continue exploring whether or not legislature as a whole or as a majority thinks this is a good idea because we have 60 days to clock this ticking. And if we don't move this one piece forward in a timely fashion, and something does finally arise to cause us all to question the UPO in a significant way, then we're not able to do anything about it because we've run out of time. So, again, the spirit of keeping all of our options on the table so we can be sure we've done our due diligence, I will support the resolution today, and I'll continue watching and we continue our investigation into what the implications might be. So thank you for your indulgence for that long comment. All right. Because also, as I mentioned here, I don't need to ask any questions. I want to begin by thanking the department for the incredible amount of work that has been ongoing related to this issue, as well as making yourselves available for dialogue with this committee about the process to this point. I also really want to thank Legislator Fiegel for being the nonpartisan examiner to the legislature to understand the legal implications of the decisions that were making as a committee. I think over the course of the dialogue that we've had related to Executive Order 121, the importance of finding solutions to wide-ranging crucial programs that serve vulnerable populations of Alaskans and families and elders that are in crisis, these programs that are in crisis, is very clear. I think the department has done an incredible job of demonstrating that there are needs for programmatic improvements. There are needs for making money that Alaska spent on these resources work smarter. But I have not been convinced that Executive Order 121 is the means to accomplish that. I want to put on the record my concern that echoes the nonpartisan recommendations and those advising people that the executive order has legal and fiscal ambiguity is that if there are real consequences for the institution and the legislature. And unfortunately, given the 60-day deadline for consideration, alongside the magnitude of the new precedent that is set for the future powers of legislators, in particular the legal ambiguity and risk for executive authority to the legislative court, that we have made our choice but to be in favor of continuing to consider whether to disapprove of the executive order. Thank Representative Pinker for talking about the constitutional authority outlined in Article 3.10.23 that permits the governor to make changes to the organization. They also want to highlight what the title indicates, which is that there's little authority to regulate on the permissible scope of an executive order. And while among the brain permissible executive order, impermissible policy enactments still defined, the line nevertheless exists. And we misunderstand that as a legislature, in order to allow the executive order to proceed, we are setting significant precedent. Now that future administrations and legislatures will certainly not look back to. Previous executive orders have frequently been referenced in the current discussion of the one before us, and Executive Order 121 dwarfs any of the prior executive orders in size and scope. And while some of the legal issues that we identified last year seem to be buttoned up, this is certainly a signal that reorganization of this magnitude and the size and scope is permissible, and we as legislators need an incredible amount of policy-making power to the executive. To be clear, in terms of talking about constitutional authority, Article 2, Section 1 of our Constitution vests the legislative power exclusively in the legislature. And I can't step away from or separate my desire to support the incredible work of the department from the concern that the executive order remains a statute in a matter that may be considered substantive. And from my colleagues' conservative estimate that a bill would be more completely equal to a proper sentence in the end that's being proposed. But similar to the position that I took last year, I think that allowing the executive to intentionally or unintentionally usurp the legislature's constitutionally mandated powers would violate the systems and checks and balances laid out by the framers of our Constitution. And on a final kind of thought related to this issue, similar to Bridger Snyder, I did a quick assessment over the last 3 fiscal years, frankly looking at behavioral health, children's services, public assistance, public health. There is a conservative estimate that could be made that over the last 3 fiscal years, the legislature has cut $40 million in fiscal positions for the delivery of services. And cutting frontline positions like public assistance, eligibility specialists, clinicians at EPI, OCS retention strategies in favor of six-figure salaries and overhead expenses for a commissioner's office is not a sensible nor policy practice that I can support. I will say that it's really challenging if the department is unable to deliver on the promise of reorganizing seamlessly, and we've already seen, as we've heard in testimony today, amendments to the budget to add positions to facilitate the work being done to reorganize. It could be a massive amount of unforeseen expenses that we are tying not just this legislature but future legislatures to. And so for the basic economic policy positions from the consumer, the legal ambiguity relating to those from the concern about the constitutional ability that is not exceeding any authority of the legislative branch. I think that it's important to pass this resolution today for the purpose of continuing dialogue as a legislative body to really understand how we protect programs and policies, but also protect the integrity of public institution, moving forward opportunity. So part of our design, and we've done a general motion to the resolution of our committee. We're so excited. Thank you, Chair Zubretsky. Special Concurrent Resolution 2, Reporter 32-OS1564-B from Committee with Inclusion Recommendations and attached to the Zero Fiscal Note. Is there an objection?
Object.
Thank you, Chair. Perhaps you'd like to speak to your objection.
I think this message is
very well. If the Court could please call the roll. Yes. Concerned about conflict been relating to the whiteboard and some of these fun facts that people can create on our whiteboarding. If you could, you know, kind of describe in more detail, you know, some of the context that you see and how you think that the whiteboard can approach this.
Sure.
Action
Thank you.
questions for Dr. Hamel. One final question that I will ask is to Dr. Hamel. What are some areas that you are interested in and that you see as a priority in Alaska in terms of your service on the state level board?
Well, being the first pediatric physician of the board, this is a medical surgeon, and I think that we're the last of four states that limits access to foot ankle specialists due to some of the things put in place within the Medicaid system 50 years ago, 1972. And I
sorry, and we now close the test time. Again, we'd like to thank you for taking the time to be with us for doing the work. And now, we are going to turn to another of the governor's appointees to the medical board. We will hear from David Wilson. Mr. Wilson, if you can begin by introducing yourself for the record, tell us about yourself and why you are interested in serving on the state medical board.
Good afternoon. Thank you for the opportunity and your time to meet with me. I just a brief statement on who I am and my interest in the state medical board. My name is Dave Wilson, and I've applied for the public position on the state medical board. I'm a Senator County Captain for Los Angeles. I serve as the Anchorage Chair of the Professional Standards Board. I'm going to serving on the state medical board somehow to get back to the state level community. I see my role as serving two aspects as a public member on the state medical board. First, as representing the perspective of the patient, particularly from the rural Alaska community that faces the greatest logistical challenges of obtaining medical care. Second, as the experience of human factors analysis of the patient safety. The state medical board is not unlike the professional standards board that I currently serve from, and requires a team of unbiased professionals that are methodical and tenacious in the pursuit of the truth and leave the absolute integrity of functioning of the condition. The professional standards board is the first line of defense in getting the medical behavioral and compliant issues. Standards board medical professionals are highly trained and self-motivated. Carry a tremendous amount of responsibility for the lives of those that are under their care, and are often called upon to make life-altering decisions, often with very limited time and data. At times, the process is further complicated by external influences, such as one of the eventual concern of non-reporters, personal financial influences, substance abuse, strained relationships at home, or conflicts within the work environment. The state doctor finds a completely different matter, though. It often begins early and often leads to training with evidence, to performance reviews, training records, and disciplinary action. Despite this evidence, titles often successfully promote to the right and transition, and many employers do it in large part to get a man of talent in the realm of active play. Unfortunately, it isn't until someone is injured and the post-event investigation exposes the betrayal of misconduct. They cannot afford to play the game of chance with misconduct. You see, professionalism and non-compliance are both very contagious to the workplace. One leads to mutual trust and understanding, while the other is a huge undercurrent of tension and doubt. Either of us can accommodate new admission or nursing. I believe that behavioral deviation from standard operation procedures and highly regulated industries such as medicine and admission are often influenced by influence by external pressures. We can only understand and address these problems and really have to drill down to the underlying root causes and fully address them before we can expect any meaningful change towards my role in the professional standards board is to help our pilots identify and address the underlying cause of their conflict or behavior and then assist them in getting help if needed. It is my hope to bring this same approach to the U.S. State Medical Board.
Thank you so much for
professional standards board that is served by our pilots, was that a national board there or a state board?
That is actually a national board of the Airline Pilots Association that has been there in the past for 5 years.
Okay, thank you. Some questions for Mr. Wilson.
Thank you to the chair, Mr. Wilson. I view humanity like an iceberg, and that has immense, and what we need to deal with at the surface of the water is not all what really exists and is huge. You think we're like the razor blade on the top of the iceberg, right, where you try to understand humanity. And I'm wondering, as we look at the profession of medicine, that there's two parts to it, the science of medicine and the art of medicine. And what is your thought on the aspect of the immense nature of the science of medicine as well as the artful process in that there? And your statement of some of the systematic professional standards format, how does that merge, or how do you want to invest in it?
Investigation is to find the root causes, as you were talking about, and
sometimes it goes beyond just the regulations that are in place. I'm wondering if you have given some thought about how that, how bringing that experience might benefit the overall medical board.
I appreciate that question. I'm only answering the first segment of what we think there was a list of folks that had the counseling malpractice cases done. And we also have a
thank you.
Can you ask me one more time, please?
Sure. The state medical board is tasked with adopting regulations that establish guidelines for physicians. What experience or qualifications do you feel you have that have prepared you to do this work on this board?
Thank you. That's a really good question. Thank you. First of all, in my career, I was on the side of the position of chief development. The main position had a lot of older experience, one of which was to take the primary regulations that represent the medicines of the chief and all that.
Back on the record, thank you, Mr. Wilson, for your testimony before the committee today. We are going to return to public testimony on Mr. Wilson's appointment. We need to come back on testimony. Is there anyone in the room who wishes to testify? Is there anyone on the line who would like to testify? Seeing none, so we know who testified is on the line or in the room. Public testimony. We'd like to thank you, Mr. Wilson, for your time today, for the moment that we can bring ideas to that we talked about scheduling issues. The testimony from and on these updates she's completed is my intent to move these meetings for consideration in joint session. Please remember that moving these forward does not reflect the intent of how any members on this committee vote in joint session. Are there any objections to moving these names forward? Seeing and hearing none, the House Health and Social Services Committee has reviewed qualifications for the governor's appointees of Stone Blue and recommends that the names be forwarded to a joint session for consideration. Both Dr. Matt Hanover, the State Medical Board, as well as Mr. David Wilson, to the State Medical Board. I would ask committee members to stick around after we adjourn to sign the committee report. And the next meeting of the House Health and Social Services Committee will be meeting on Thursday, March 3rd at 9 p.m. for the date of 406. We will return to House Bill 265 by Representative Smallhope on telehealth. We will have an initial hearing on House Bill 282 by Representative Sayer related to Health and Communities Labor Services. Finally, we will also hear from Kevin Fannin, appointee to the Alaska Health Trust Authority. This time is 5:03 p.m. and the hearing of the House Health and Social Services Committee is now adjourned.